From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made over the last month with a couple of headlines that, at least to my novice eyes, look like pretty big news. We're going to learn about that coming up here. We're talking about the implications for people living with Parkinson's disease. For example, a study came out really conclusively showing the benefits of exercise. It turns out that exercise can slow the progression of Parkinson's. We've heard a lot about that, but it's great to have more data to support this. And then on March 22nd, the first new Parkinson's disease medication for motor symptoms in 10 years was approved by the FDA. So just how big of news is that for the Parkinson's community? And then take a look at what's going on locally. There's other research happening now. There's a lot to tell you about advancements helping people through telemedicine, helping people who need that kind of outreach and help. And there's an event coming up on Saturday at the Hyatt Regency in Rochester that we'll tell you about as well. So a lot to discuss this hour. Let me go ahead and welcome our guests. Yvonne Hilton is here. Her diagnosis of Parkinson's came 10 years ago. And Yvonne, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Also here is Pat Smith. Pat is a caregiver, a longtime caregiver who has been involved in various issues related to that. And we're going to be discussing finding caregiving and some of the work that Pat does. Welcome to the program. Great to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also here is Dr. Ray Dorsey, who is a professor of neurology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Dorsey, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Rich Schneider is a senior instructor in the Department of Neurology, Movement Disorders at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Schneider, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Dr. Dorsey was telling me sort of pump the brakes on your excitement about some of these things. You know, I see these headlines, you know, first new medication in 10 years and study on the benefits of exercise. Big news, moderate news, how do you categorize it?
Well, exercise is the single most important thing that individuals with Parkinson's disease can do. We know from extensive studies, especially over the last 10 years, that the more people with Parkinson's disease exercise, the better they do. And there are people in this room who can speak to that from a firsthand experience. We also know even from animal models of Parkinson's disease, rats with Parkinson's disease who are on the treadmill tend to do better and have more nerve cells remaining than rats who don't exercise.
Okay, and the medication thing you said, kind of like not as big of a deal as it seems.
Well, there's a new medication called safinamide, which has been recently approved by the FDA to treat people who have motor fluctuations, periods where their medications work well and periods where it doesn't work well. This is the third medication in that class of drugs. More importantly, over the last 2 years, we've had about four or five new FDA-approved treatments, including treatments for people with advanced Parkinson's disease and including surgical treatment. So as a whole, there's a lot of research and a lot of advances and a lot more hope for individuals with Parkinson's disease.
All right. Well, let me turn to Yvonne, who was first diagnosed 10 years ago now. And so take me back to those early days, if you could, how much you felt like you knew about Parkinson's and what your story is, Yvonne.
At the time, I really didn't know anything about it. Dr. Dorsey, as a matter of fact, was the person who gave me the diagnosis. And I remember he said, people don't die from Parkinson's. They die from basically extenuating circumstances. And at the time, that wasn't a lot of comfort. But over these past 10 years, I've learned much more about it. And I've come to look at Parkinson's more as an ally and a teacher, as opposed to a demon or a foe, because it's given me a lot of opportunities. I'm probably in better shape than I was 10 years ago, and I've had an opportunity to help a lot of other people, and that's been an important part of getting through the diagnosis as well.
I was telling Yvonne before the program began that just reading, for example, something that she wrote for the Democrat and Chronicle about her experience was really instructive for me because, you know, it was different than other experiences I've heard with Parkinson's. And then Yvonne said, well, of course, because they call it the snowflake disease, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is different person to person.
It's so, and I'm sure the doctors could add more to this than even I can, but every person, you know, the transition, the timeline of the disease, how you progress over time, how quickly it progresses, different symptoms. Some people lose their sense of smell almost immediately at a very young age before physical symptoms begin. Some people have just terribly oppressive anxiety or depression. Other people have a tremor, and I'm grateful to say I haven't experienced any of those things. Maybe a mild tremor would be noted by the doctors, but you know, the depression that some of my friends deal with, I'm just so grateful that that's not something that's layered on top of the disease. And as I said, is that people you know, move forward in their own diagnosis, their motor symptoms are all different as well. Some people have stiffness in their neck, or they have dystonia where their hands or feet kind of curl up and they're unable to to loosen their grips. It's fascinating.
And if I can ask then, Jevon, this is where my ignorance shows. I would have thought, you know, you go back 10 years ago to your diagnosis, and from the stories that I've heard shared with me personally, Parkinson's, people living with Parkinson's, often it is, you know, an early tremor or some kind of a symptom that would lead one to want to get an understanding. But for you, what was it that led to that?
Believe it or not, I had to concentrate on lifting my feet off the floor. I'd be standing at the sink doing dishes, and I had to physically get my brain to connect with my feet to move them, and I thought, that's weird. And then in the shower, washing my hair, I would try to step back to rinse my hair, and I would have to, like, connect my brain with my feet again. So that coupled with this just incredibly overwhelming tiredness that would take over sometimes took me to a neurologist. My husband and I were living out of state at the time, and the neurologist that I saw was not a movement disorder specialist, so he did lots and lots of tests and ultimately said he wanted to send me somewhere else. And I told my husband, please, can we just go back home to Rochester and you know, let them figure it out. So things fell into place, and we moved back here. And in between the move, Dr. Dorsey saw me, and he basically spent 40 minutes with me and said, I think you have Parkinson's.
What was it in those 40 minutes, Dr. Dorsey, that led you to believe that?
You're going back 10 years, but Ms. Hilton, you know, told her story. And, it, you know, as she indicates, that people have a variety of symptoms, whether it's loss of smell, whether it's drooling, whether it's slowness of movement, whether it's trouble buttoning their shirt, whether it's trouble getting in and out of a car or in and out of a soft chair, you know, the constellation of her symptoms and her signs, especially probably at that time, difficulty walking, led us to make the clinical diagnosis.
Okay. Pat, you want to weigh in too? Go ahead.
Yes. My husband was diagnosed 15 years ago, and his symptoms were similar to Yvonne's. He put his hands on the arms of a chair, and he could not move himself out of the chair. And so he went to his family doctor, who sent him to a neurologist, and within about, he walked down the magic corridor, which is part of the clinical diagnosis, and by the time he got to the other end, the doctor knew that it was Parkinson's, that he wasn't firing his muscles. At that time, we were scheduled to go to Europe in about 2 weeks, and so we thought we weren't going to be able to do it. So the neurologist gave him a magic pill called Sinemet, and we were able to do that. And while parked in a very narrow parking space in England, he was able to climb over the steering column. And 2 weeks before that, he couldn't have done it.
Wow.
So he started out like that, and he's had similar situations to what Yvonne has. He does not have a tremor.
If I can ask the doctors then, you know, we take for granted just the amazing complexities of the brain, the way the brain can operate our entire body. I want to lift my hand, I lift my hand. I don't have to think consciously the way Yvonne had to think in the shower. Now I have to lift my foot and move it to a different place. It just happens. Mm-hmm. Is there something in Parkinson's that can basically disconnect the easy fluidity we have to make those things happen? Is that part of it?
So Parkinson's disease is a chronic and progressive neurological disorder, and it's characterized by loss of the neurons or the brain cells that produce a chemical called dopamine. And the loss of this chemical results in a variety of different symptoms, from a lot of the motor symptoms that have been described, so shaking, slowness of movement, freezing of gait, which is what Yvonne is describing, and just difficulty in mobility overall, and also non-motor symptoms like anxiety and depression, urinary symptoms, lightheadedness, constipation. There's a wide variety of symptoms.
And Yvonne, were there any moments where you couldn't do it, or you know, whether you're standing there brushing your teeth and thinking, now I've got to do this, or were you always able to make it happen? It was just with a lot of effort.
At first, it was definitely with a lot of effort. The latter. It started out just troublesome. I knew something wasn't just right. Mm-hmm. And that's another kind of hallmark of the disease, that as it progresses, it gets a little harder, and you're always wondering, is it the disease or is it something else? You know, is there some confounding factor that's making it more difficult to move today? Is it my shoe selection, or is it the carpeting, or is it the weather? And you're kind of always wrestling with that because the disease keeps crawling along, even though you might be taking medication and compensating, the disease keeps marching on. So you're always trying to keep them in step, I guess.
And do you ever wonder if it's fatigue? I mean, there was a separate piece written for the DNC by your husband describing occasionally trouble sleeping through the night. I mean, are you thinking about that as well?
Sure, sure. As I said, there's so many things that confound the situation. I've had deep brain stimulation, so I'm wired, if you will. And before that surgery, I was having a terrible time sleeping, and lack of sleep makes symptoms worse. Mm-hmm. So now I have DBS, and my sleep is better, but anxiety or just nervousness can make the symptoms worse. When you get plenty of sleep, but still have stress, for example, overwhelm you. And little things that you take for granted, and not to be too personal, but, you know, a bowel movement can just wipe you out, so to speak. You just be so exhausted. So it's little things that you just take for granted in regular life, daily life, that slip away.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you're wired, is how you described it. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, I have a battery pack in my chest. It looks about like a pack of cigarettes under the skin, and an electrode on each side of the brain. And those electrodes, the doctors will probably, again, be able to explain this much more technically than I can, but there's signals that they can send to the brain. And those signals can be set up in such a way, it's sort of like a garden hose. They can send a frequency that's, you know, high and high or low, if it's wide or short, wide or so on. And depending on that frequency and where it hits in the brain, it can kind of make the brain produce a little bit more dopamine, or it can settle down a part of the brain. So, for example, movements will become, I could perhaps relax from a dystonia, or I use mine pretty exclusively now to give me a little bit more energy when I work out. So I use my DBS in that way.
Can I just ask one more question for you, and then the doctors will fill in on how amazing modern medicine is? It's just incredible to hear this. But are you controlling the impact? I mean, I have this image that you've got like this clicker, and that you just, you know.
Well, my husband wants to take it away.
Right? That's not where I was actually going, but okay. Yeah. Now, are you controlling it in that way?
I can. I have a bandwidth. My neurologist programs me, and she'll have the optimal settings. Sometimes you typically shall have two different programs, but we keep it on one program, and I'm able to adjust the bandwidth slightly so that I can adjust it and as I said, give myself a bit more energy for an hour or so.
I'm holding holding it right now here. Yeah, it's like holding a small
garage door opener.
Yeah.
And my husband also has DBS.
Amazing. Mm-hmm.
It is amazing.
How does he use it then?
Well, when he first got it, he had the remote and he was changing it all the time. Mm-hmm. And he had it in 2008, so the original one, the remote.
It is like men who can't keep the channel in the
exactly.
same place, isn't it? It really
yes.
is.
And the original remote was about the size of a travel iron. It was supposed to attach it to your waist, so I took it away from him. Mm-hmm. So we check it periodically. But he has been programmed. He's had the battery pack replaced either two or three times now, but about every 3 years. It just wears out.
Pat, do you have to learn not to sort of obsess over it and kind of not
oh, yes.
check it all the time?
Yeah. Oh, exactly. So we don't obsess over it. Mm-hmm. And the concern about having him change it all the time is with the old version of it, you didn't know where you started, so you didn't know where you were. And so you couldn't go back where you used to be. With the new one, you can do that. But it's there, and it's wonderful, and it's the original programming, which makes it work like the operating system, so to speak, in a computer, is done. It's strong. And then within certain parameters, we can change it to make him feel better. Now, in our case, it's much simpler than what Yvonne's trying to do because she's trying to work on exercise, so she needs a little extra to do certain things, and he does not.
It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it is.
And so I think Yvonne and Pat have given you a good sense of how it works for in their situations. Let me ask the doctors to kind of just fill in any gaps and explain exactly how it's designed to work and how common this is and how newish this is, Doctor?
So deep brain stimulation is a relatively new therapeutic. Patients with Parkinson's disease, as the disease progresses, can develop what we call motor fluctuations and dyskinesias. Motor fluctuations are essentially means you have times when the medications seem to be working really well and addressing your symptoms very well, and other times where the medications seem to wear off and are not addressing your symptoms. Dyskinesias are involuntary, kind of extra wiggly movements that people can get and can sometimes be quite bothersome. So those are the main indications for doing deep brain stimulation. We also do it in people who have severe shaking or tremor that doesn't respond to the medications that we traditionally use to treat Parkinson's disease. And what it involves is insertion of a lead into the brain, into a part called the basal ganglia that controls motor and movement. And this is connected to a wire that hooks into the battery pack that is implanted under the skin in your chest. And by controlling the current that is delivered, we can disrupt the circuitry in the brain and affect people's symptoms and ideally help them feel better and function better.
Do you have a sense for what percentage of Parkinson's patients now are going to get DBS eventually?
I don't have a global sense, but I can say I do think it's increasing. There is research coming out to show that we should be doing it earlier. And not waiting until the disease is more advanced. So I think that number will be increasing with time.
Doctor, you want to weigh in as well?
It's about 10% of individuals. And I think more generally what you're hearing is that Parkinson's disease is an eminently treatable condition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I spoke to Ms. Hilton before coming in. I think she's better today than she was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, one, a testament to her and to her husband. I think it's, two, also the testament to what can happen when you get really good care. I think it's also a testament of what happened when you can get really new therapies that
That's
benefit
right.
from research.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to add something to that, and you're absolutely right. When my husband had DBS, there was a question as to whether or not he should have it because he was 72. But he really aced the neuropsych test, and so they gave it to him, which was wonderful because at that point in time, his symptoms were mainly in his legs, and he was unable to walk, and not just a gait situation, but to able to hold his body up above it, and he's not a huge man. Once he had the DBS, that problem went away. But if he had not had it, he'd be in a wheelchair.
Wow. Well, what I want to do is, there's so much to discuss here, and I'm just wrapped up in these personal stories. I want you, in a moment, I'm going to ask Yvonne to talk a little bit more about exercise, because she said she might be in better shape today than 10 years ago when she got the diagnosis. And we know exercise is so important. If you don't mind, Pat, can you just share a little bit more about your husband's story and how that diagnosis, you kind of shared that story a little bit about, you're going to Europe, you found a way to get
exactly.
on that Europe trip, but then are you thinking about, you know, the rest of your life and what's going to change and how much you had to learn at that point?
Well, the interesting thing about the diagnosis was he had hammer toes, he had a back issue where he could stand and lie down, could not sit for some time before, and then we learned in later years that these can be pre-Parkinson's symptoms, the stiffness, et cetera, et cetera. When he was diagnosed, the doctor said, the good news is it's not Alzheimer's, the bad news is it's Parkinson's. And I said, oh, because that was when Muhammad Ali and Michael J. Fox were making the TV rounds. Mm-hmm. And so they were talking about Parkinson's. And then the two of us looked at that and said, oh, it's something we can deal with. Now, I should give you some background on my husband. My husband is a veterinarian and a clinical pharmacologist who worked in the pharmacy industry developing drugs for animals. And so he had this scientific background. And we're both pretty practical people. So we said, okay, now here's the situation. We need to figure out how to deal with it. So we did not feel overwhelmed. And he immediately started to work on the medications, et cetera. And then after the DBS, decided he needed to do things for other people, which is when we started the Parkinson's support group that we did in Canandaigua, which has grown by leaps and bounds.
I was going to ask you how much it's changed.
Oh, it is. Yeah, when we started it in 2008, We had 12 people today for the first meeting, and they said they wanted to learn something and they wanted to share. These two doctors have both come to speak to help people learn things. And today, 40 to 50 people come to our monthly meetings. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really great. Yeah. Well, and what about exercise and physical activity for him, Pat?
For him, for a long period of time until recently, he was working with a gentleman called the Tall Trainer.
Who runs the Tall Trainer.
Who runs boot camps. Well, Jeremy and he worked one-on-one for quite a long time until about 6 months
ago. He's not that tall, by the way. Dr. Dorsey is way taller.
Absolutely. That's true. We should challenge Jeremy on that. But anyway, it started not to work as well because of his age and where he is and his advanced Parkinson's. But we found recently, so we stopped going to Jeremy, but we found recently that there's a program offered by the Center for Disability Rights. It's actually in Canandaigua, although they're situated in Rochester. And so there's a day social program that he has decided he likes very much in the last couple months. And included in that is some chair exercises. So that's one of the things he looks forward to when he goes to that.
Okay. And Yvonne, for you, you know, whether it's yoga or something else here, why don't you tell me 10 years ago to today, you know, how your exercise regimen has changed?
Well, it's gotten more robust, I'll say that. It started out, my husband and I walked every day. We still try to walk many times through the week. And yoga has been a big part of my practice for quite a while. At the time of diagnosis, I was probably practicing at least 3 or 4 times a week. But it became clear that I needed to do more, so we kind of ramped up the walking a bit. We walked about 3.5 miles a day, and yoga, and I started boxing. And non-contact boxing, just for to clarify, but that's been huge. And I've found that it's having someone push you. It's really, yoga has definitely had its benefits in terms of balance and so on, but there's nothing that compares to having your heart beat, you know, up there for an hour and having someone, you know, kind of pushing you along. I can't say enough about the Rock Steady Boxing program. They welcome people of all abilities for people with Parkinson's, but it's been amazing, and I really feel as though my medications are, you know, my off times are practically nil. I'm working on having more energy. As I mentioned earlier, you're always trying to keep pace with the disease because it doesn't slow down. It just keeps, you know, crawling along. And I can tell that the workouts are getting harder, even though I don't sense, you know, in time that they're really changing that much. But I think it's getting harder for me. For example, when my husband and I go for walks, it's necessary for me to hold on to him to keep the pace because otherwise I fall behind. I can't talk and I can't have a conversation and keep up with him. I must hang on to his arm, otherwise I will slow down and I'll fall woefully behind. It sounds crazy, but that's the way it works. And
it doesn't sound crazy.
My neurologist explains it that when we're working so hard and we're using up our energy, that kind of depletes our checking account, our short-term energy checking account. And after these workouts, I go home and I have to take an hour nap. So my investment in my physical health is an hour of exercise and plan an hour nap. Mm-hmm. And that's a chunk of the day. Mm-hmm. But that contributes to building up your energy 401k because that represents your endurance. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to work on. I'm trying to keep that as high as I can or build it as high as I can. And so I can still enjoy those trips and the things that we still want to pack in before it gets not possible.
I think you wrote in one of your pieces that you can't walk and chew gum at the same time. And
I wasn't kidding.
You meant that.
Truly.
But that's, but for you, is it dystonia? Is that the term that I heard you use? When you kind of freeze up, can that impact your exercise?
Well, it can. There are friends who can't, you know, can't relax their fingers. I've had a dystonia in my feet there's a Botox that they use for that to relax the muscles in your feet so that I can stand with more, I'd be more stable. If other times, if my feet are curling up, you can tend to fall forward, or it essentially messes up your balance. But yeah, the short answer is yes, you can have things interfere.
Well, in our second half hour here, we're going to talk about research going on here in our area. We'll tell you about an event coming up on Saturday, and we're going to tell you about telemedicine. Dr. Dorsey is going to tell us more about that. We're going to talk about finding caregivers and what you ought to know if you or someone you know or someone you love is in that position. So there's a lot to get to. But I would just say, Yvonne, just talking to you for this half hour, you are a remarkable example of quality of life, I would think. You know, I mean, truly, 10 years on, I don't think I would have thought it's been 10 years since your diagnosis. I mean, what do I know at all? Nothing. But you really are pretty remarkable, hearing your story and seeing how physically fit you are and hearing that. So I just want to thank you for sharing it.
Thanks for letting me share. As I said earlier on, it's really important to me to give back and just let people know this isn't the end. I mean, there's plenty of time to get into things that you really want to do and make every minute count. And that's what that's the gift that this has given me. You know, Dr. Dorsey said, go out and live your life.
You're doing it. You're doing amazing things. And Dr. Dorsey, when you mentioned earlier that she might, you know, look like she's in better shape now than 10 years ago, I would think that you'd want as many people as whoever come into your office with this diagnosis, they should see people like Yvonne and think, not only is it not the end, but there's really good times ahead, and that treatment and management is has to be better than ever, right?
Absolutely. But I think the challenge is that we've heard great stories from Ms. Hilton and from Mrs. Smith's husband, but over 40% of people with Parkinson's disease don't see a neurologist, and those that don't do as well as the individuals here.
Yeah.
And we're thinking there's a fundamental flaw in the way we provide care to individuals with Parkinson's disease in general. We healthy clinicians ask sick patients to come see us on our terms, and instead healthy clinicians should be seeing the sick patients on their terms.
You want to add to that, Pat?
Yeah, I wanted to add to that, and you're absolutely right. My husband went to his family doctor, who sent him to a general neurologist who treated him for a period of time and still does treat him. He manages the meds. But when the time came for John to need more care, he sent him to the University of Rochester to Dr. Marshall, and that was the absolutely perfect thing. So now we have a greater team working on it.
Well, let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back. You're hearing Yvonne Hilton's story, her remarkable story. Pat Smith is caregiver for her husband, and she's been involved with helping people find caregivers. We're going to talk more about that coming up here. We also have Dr. Ruth Schneider, who is a senior instructor in the Department of Neurology and Movement Disorders at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and Dr. Ray Dorsey, who is a professor of neurology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. A lot more coming up after this only break of the hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It is April 4th. It's not a week ago. Not really sure why we ran last week's promo, other than I made a mistake in recording one earlier. Put it in the wrong spot. It happens. So we're not doing gentrification tomorrow. That was a great show, by the way. You can find all of our shows podcasted WXXINews.org/connections. Every hour is podcasted there. But we have some other things coming up tomorrow. And not the least of which is the question on healthcare. I'm not going to ask these doctors about the American Healthcare Act. They're thrilled to hear that. But we're going to talk more tomorrow about whether this is the first sign that the Democrats are sort of debating about how to kind of get through to people who supported Donald Trump. And a lot of Trump voters have said in the last couple of weeks they were upset with the AHCA. And the question is, you know, what does that mean going forward, not just for healthcare, but for reaching voters? So we're going to talk about that and a lot more tomorrow. That's what we're doing tomorrow. Today we're talking about Parkinson's disease, research and treatment. And I should ask our guests to tell you what's coming up on Saturday, April 8th at the Hyatt Regency Rochester. Who wants to grab that one? What's coming up on Saturday? Dr. Schneider, you're up. Go ahead.
So Saturday, we have the National Parkinson's Foundation of Greater Rochester Annual Parkinson's Symposium. It is at the Hyatt Regency downtown on East Main Street. And registration opens at 8:15, and it runs till about 1:15 in the afternoon. And we'll have a number of wonderful speakers there, including Dr. Dorsey and others, Dr. Schulman and Dr. Zwicky, who will be speaking about quality of life and nutrition. And the focus will be on living your best life, so addressing exercise and diet and staying active.
All right, so that's coming up. And how can people get involved there?
So if you'd like to register, you can go to the www.nationalparkinsonsnpfgreaterrochester.org. And I should mention also that Yvonne will be the MC for that event.
Looking forward to that, Yvonne?
I am, but believe me, it was because everyone else was booked.
I sort of doubt that. That is coming up on Saturday. We're talking Parkinson's disease research and treatment. There's a lot of places we could go, but let me just start by asking Dr. Schneider in this half hour here to just tell us about some of the other research and that is going on, because I always feel like, you know, when you find out the kind of things that are happening, especially locally, it is amazing what's going on in terms of understanding treatment, understanding the research, the future of the disease. What's going on right now?
So at the University of Rochester, we participate in a number of different research studies relating to Parkinson's disease. We have trials going on that relate to finding treatments that might slow or halt the progression of the disease. Others that are looking at reducing the off time or the time where the medications don't seem to be working. We also have a study looking at a medication for the treatment of anxiety in Parkinson's disease. Traditionally, a lot of our studies have focused on the motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease, but we're starting to devote more research and more time to management and treatment of the non-motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease, which can be equally debilitating and really affect your quality of life. In addition to those, Dr. Dorsey and others are working on a number of studies looking at the use of telemedicine, smartphones, and sensor technology for the objective assessment of Parkinson's disease symptoms.
All right, before I get to telemedicine, a couple of times this hour, multiple guests have mentioned the term off times. What do we mean, Dr. Schneider, by off times?
So early on with Parkinson's disease, when you start medications, the medications tend to work quite well and you get a nice smooth response from them. So improvement in symptoms such as shaking, slowness of movement, and stiffness of movement. However, as the disease progresses, your brain becomes less adept at handling the medications, and we can develop fluctuations in off time. So times when the medication seems to be working well, but also others where it just doesn't seem to be working.
Okay. You want to tell us a little bit about how it impacts you, Yvonne?
I currently take medication every 2 hours.
Every 2 hours, okay.
So I'm not experiencing much off time at this point. And I credit that to the exercise, having just kind of generally boosting up my ability to manage the medication. One of the big drivers for having DBS was the fact that I was taking medication every 2 hours at that back then, and it wasn't lasting. So I could take medication at 1 o'clock, and by 2 o'clock, I would feel like the Tin Man without oil, you know, just all kind of seized up. Or the other side, you'd take medication and immediately just start having the, you know, twitches and kind of almost a jittery twitch. So my neurologist, it was very much in favor of having DBS early, rather than waiting for it, so that you could get yourself, if it's physically fit and able to, you know, get kind of take on the battle, rather than wait until you'd lost some physical mobility. So, the off time is something that I fortunately don't have to deal with until later in the evening. Those doses aren't typically as effective, but by the end of the day, I have worked that into my schedule. So,
okay, Pat, what about you and your family?
Early on, I guess, and in the middle of this, what we talk about oft times, we had what I described as a sinusoidal curve. It didn't matter whether the meds were taken on time or not, whether they were missed or whatever. There would be the on times when the meds were taken or the off times when the meds were taken. It was just really bizarre. Today it's more of the typical one. And he takes meds every 3 hours, and he takes a whole cocktail of things. Every time he takes a med, it's different. So it's a whole variety of those. Okay. But we do have off times, so something that would reduce that would be just wonderful.
Okay. Well, we heard mentioned that Dr. Dorsey is doing some things with telemedicine, and I think it's important to talk about what that means and what you're doing for people, Dr. Dorsey. So tell us about that.
So telemedicine is nothing more than using the internet or similar technologies to connect to patients where they are instead of asking patients to come see clinicians where they are. And so it turns out about 25 to 50% of people in Monroe County and about 40% of people around in the country but Parkinson's don't access neurological care, and those that don't are more likely to die, more likely to be placed in a skilled nursing facility, and more likely to fracture their hip. So thanks to generous support from the Greater Rochester Health Foundation and other foundations, we've launched a program called Parkinson's Disease Care New York, which for the first time enables anyone in the state of New York with Parkinson's disease to receive the care that they need, regardless of who they are, where they live, or their ability to pay. And so we're able to connect to people who maybe because either their age or disability or simply because of where they live can get access to great neurologists. We think they were great neurologists at the University of Rochester, and receive that care directly in their home. And again, they get all this for free.
So there's ways to get in touch here. And mind if I read some of these here? So, for example, you can find out if you're eligible for free Parkinson's disease care. You can call 844-77-PDCNY. That's 844-777-3269. You can jump online, pdcny.org, or you can email pdcny at urmc.rochester.edu. And just as an example, already hearing from a listener who writes the following, says, and this is a term I don't know. I don't know if this was auto-corrected or if this is just a term I don't know. He said, I'd like to hear some discussion about Parkinson's with, I don't know if he meant lower or L-E-W-Y, body dementia. He says, this is something that my family is dealing with right now, and we're doing a telemedicine program through the U of R. Telemedicine has really helped my rural parents get in touch with world-class Parkinson's doctors. How's that for an endorsement?
Yes, thank you. So we've heard people who are doing really well with their Parkinson's disease, and it's a testament, again, to them, their community, and the clinicians who are caring for them. But there are people who aren't doing well with Parkinson's disease who either have advanced Parkinson's disease, have had it for 10, 20 years, and they can get dementia, difficulty thinking, they can get hallucinations, and the constellation of having the motor symptoms, the cognitive impairment, and hallucinations is called diffuse Lewy body disease. And for these individuals, they really need to have the care delivered to them at their home. I don't know, Mrs. Smith's husband's not here with us today, but you know, I suspect there are a lot of people who just find the act of going to see their doctor to be burdensome. And for people who live, you know, 50 or 100 miles away, or who live in Wayne County or Genesee County, there just aren't very many neurologists and very few Parkinson's disease specialists. And we don't think people should be determined what care they get based on where they live. We think you should be able to get the care you need regardless of where you live. And now we have the means to do so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pat?
Yeah, it is a wonderful program, but in our case, my husband loves his doctors and loves going to visit them. And so it's kind of a smiling party when we do, no matter what the diagnosis.
That's great. In fact, here's Trish on Twitter writing the following. My dad had Parkinson's, and it was tough, but he had physical therapy 2 times a week at a university on Long Island that specialized in Parkinson's, and it helped him so, so much. We had an issue with a regular neurologist not diagnosing or helping originally. It's so important, though, to go to a movement disorders specialist. That's from Trish on Twitter.
Amen.
So just to add to that, so Parkinson's disease is what we call a clinical diagnosis, which means when patients come in, they tell us what's going on and we examine them, and that's how we make the diagnosis. So there isn't a blood test or an imaging test or any type of test that we can do to confirm the diagnosis, which is really underscores the importance of going to see a specialist in Parkinson's.
Okay. And what would you recommend for people if they end up in a position like Trish where they feel like, I'm not sure I'm getting what I need here, even if it's out of a neurologist, or they're concerned that maybe it's hard. We don't want to overrule the doctors. And I'm sure doctors don't want to have patients who feel, well, I read this on the internet, so I'm not sure what you're telling me is correct here, because I'm sure you hear that. But at the same time, I think it's still worth telling people, you know, if you're still concerned, what would you have them do, Dr. Schneider?
So I think if you're still concerned, it's always reasonable to have a second opinion, and that's oftentimes a matter of personal choice and personal preference, and it's not something that we object to as doctors, and we are happy to facilitate that.
Very good. Beth writes to us and says, can your guest speak about DBS, deep brain stimulation for depression, and its availability in this area?
So there are numerous indications for doing deep brain stimulation. I talked specifically about the indications within Parkinson's disease, but there are other areas where this is an active area of research. To my knowledge, we do not do any deep brain stimulation for depression specifically here at the University of Rochester.
Okay. Are there any side effects? Anything that, things that stand out as possible concerns here with DBS?
Certainly. So there are the side effects associated with having the surgery. It is a brain surgery.
Yeah.
So we can worry about things like infection, bleeding of the brain, seizures, strokes, although the risk is relatively low. And then as the disease as time goes on, you can develop complications with the hardware that is inserted. And maybe Yvonne could speak more about complications.
Sure. How's it going for you?
It's going terrific. I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, not this is not meant to discourage anyone, but to go in with your eyes wide open, because there's a foreign object that's being placed in your brain. So even though it's very precisely located and very precisely placed and very precisely programmed, that foreign object is going through some cells that are probably, there's some good cells that are being interrupted as it goes in. And I noticed that it's very difficult to recall, bring up the right words sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Cognitively, in my case, I believe there was a tiny bit of, so other people might argue the tiny bit, but there's some cognitive decline that accompanies it. And I was willing to trade that for the mobility.
Okay. For a moment, I couldn't remember the word for not remembering words. I think it's aphasia. I don't mean to make light of it. But is that common, Dr. Schneider, to have that kind of a side effect?
So aphasia refers more to is a problem with word finding, but language in general. There are certainly, everybody is different. Everybody's experience with deep brain stimulation is different. And having some changes in cognition is something that can happen. But I'd say overall, the side effects with deep brain stimulation are fairly minimal.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Pat, you agree?
Yes. And that's one of the reasons for the neuropsychological test prior to doing it, to see where your brain
is. The one your husband aced.
The one he aced, yes. Yeah. He thought he was in there for 2 hours, but it was 20 minutes.
Your husband was the guy who was putting his pencil down 15 minutes into those exams.
Whatever, yes.
Yeah. Well, Pat, before we lose the hour here, I do want to spend some time talking about finding caregiving help mm-hmm. and support. And, you know, in 15 years since your husband's diagnosis,
yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So obviously a lot has changed, not only for you and for him, but also some of the work that you're doing in the community. So let's start out with this here. For any listener who eventually is going to be in a position where a loved one gets this diagnosis, mm-hmm. just as you were with your husband, what's step one? What would you have them start thinking about?
Well, the first thing is not to do what we did. We just assumed that life would go on, which it did for quite a period of time. It's like a 5-year honeymoon period before you start to have really difficult issues to deal with. So we thought everything would go well. And then once we needed to react to certain caregiving responsibilities, et cetera, we thought we just continued to do what we were doing. We continued to muddle in it. We really didn't step back and look at the fact that we needed help. And it took others to make us understand that we do. So if you're out there and you're stepping into this situation, your new best friend should be your local county Office of the Aging. Those are the very best people to talk to. And I also call New York Connects as a part of that now. They will be able to help you identify where you need to go, et cetera, to find help. You can casually bring in caregivers that friends have used, et cetera, but they're not considered, when you look at things like your income tax and the amount of money you're spending on those, the IRS doesn't recognize a casual person who comes in that you pay for care. They do recognize an agency who does that work for you. We had a wake-up call in 2014 when I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that wake-up call was, maybe I'll go first. And my God, I haven't done all the things I need to do to make sure John has care, because at some point we know he will need some care. And so through the Office of the Aging, they told me I needed to have an elder law attorney rather than just a regular attorney, again, a specialist. And so I went to see an elder law attorney to bring all of our documents up to date. And then the first thing he said to me after that was, why aren't you using your long-term care insurance? Now, not everybody has that. We do. So he made sure we had the connection to set up a claim so that we could have care, because we have care in the home at the moment. He thought we ought to have an aide come in the morning, and I ought to be talking to a care agency about that. He also thought that I should talk to someone about geriatric care management, And so that was an absolutely wonderful thing to do. We have a geriatric care manager who helps run the show, so I don't have to call for every single solitary thing that's coming up. I can delegate that to a person who has the training and the experience to make things happen. And the first place she made a really big difference was this time last year. I had cataract surgery, and I was not going to, for a month, be able to bend or lift. Therefore, I could not help John. And we needed to put him in respite. No agency or home in Ontario County would accept him because he needed transfer on a respite basis. So she went into the VA. He was a veteran, but he didn't qualify for a lot of veteran benefits because of the new laws. She was able to get him in respite. We made a couple of, we applied for his being accepted as a VA patient. We were rejected as usual. She had a supply because he didn't have all, he wasn't capable in all of the activities of daily living. In 4 days, he was in and had a bed. He had 30 days in the VA hospital in Canandaigua where he was treated with great respect and care. And so she's really made a difference. And since then, he now has VA as his primary care physicians and a lot of other benefits they didn't have before.
Shouldn't have been that hard, though, should it?
Should not have been that hard, no. But we are very, very lucky, very blessed that that all worked out that way. So he now has, because of the Office of the Aging as the catalyst, he has the ability to have care come in the house and things are better organized than they were before.
Okay. And for you also, when it comes to being a caregiver, you know, it's one thing if you have a family member who breaks their leg in two places, and you can say to the doctor, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. How long is the healing going to take? Mm-hmm. How much pain? Yep. Are they going to be able to get back? With Parkinson's, yeah, as I understand it, again, a snowflake disease, it's harder to say to somebody, well, what happened to you? What's going to happen to us? What's this mm-hmm. going to mean? Because it's different in case to case. Was that a challenge?
Yes, it is. And it's also it's a challenge on a day-to-day basis because in that sinusoidal curve, he could have a bad morning, and I'm supposed to be in Rochester because I have an appointment with a medical doctor for something that I need taken care of, and I might not be able to keep that appointment. And that quite often happens to the caregiver. And in many cases, the caregiver doesn't follow through and reschedule, or there isn't a way to have care come in that situation so that that person can be free to go and do what they need to do.
And Pat, now I'm thinking about people. I'm thinking about everything that you have done for mm-hmm. your husband, that you've been able to do together, either your support of him or just the fact that you have some means in your life that you can at least get some help. I'm mm-hmm. thinking about people yeah. who are either don't have someone at home, mm-hmm. they get a diagnosis, mm-hmm. or people dealing with poverty or lower mm-hmm. income, and I'm thinking about what they may need. What would you tell people to at least start exploring if you get this if you get a diagnosis, that's at least part of the battle. You mm-hmm. you understand what's going on, but you want people to have a chance to have access to care.
And that's where I go back to the Office of the Aging. Okay. That's the conduit, because there are a lot of programs out there that are free of charge. A lot of programs that offer services that can be free of charge, and also there can be transportation to get to them that's also free of charge. You just have to know where to make the application. And again, I'll go back to the Office of the Aging.
Okay. And any final thoughts for people who want to connect with caregiver services or anything else that's out there in our community?
Well, there are Lifespan has a new program called Powerful Tools for Caregivers, which is a 6-week program that they are offering that will give caregivers the tools that they need to be able to deal with all of the aspects of what they need to be doing. So that's a good one. Again, I mentioned the Center for Disability Rights with their day program, which is a wonderful thing also to be able to. Right now, John is spending today at the Center for Disability Rights, and I know he's safe, I know he's being cared for, and I know he's enjoying himself, so I can come here and do what I'm doing, which is also important.
All right, and down to our last 90 seconds, let me ask our other guests what they want to make mm-hmm. sure our audience knows about services out there, anything that they should know about what's coming up on Saturday. It's a good time to hit everything again. Dr. Mm-hmm. Dorsey, what would you want to leave the audience with?
Well, I think aging is one of the great domestic challenges of our age, and the experiences that mm-hmm. Mrs. Smith is having. Mrs. Hilden's way too young.
Yes.
But this is affecting, there's 250,000 people in Rochester, the greater Rochester mm-hmm. area, who are over 65, over 20% of the population is over 65. Many people, as you indicated, have very limited resources. So these are huge issues that we need to address, and we need to rise up as a community to address this challenge. We think one way to do that is by stop asking patients to come see us on our terms and for us to provide the care and services that they need to on their terms in their home. There's over 2 million Medicare beneficiaries today who are homebound because of various conditions. We think we need to stop rationing care or limiting care based on geography. And right now we have the means to enable anyone anywhere to receive care.
Telemedicine is one example of how to do that, right?
It's just one example.
Get online, pdcny.org, to learn more and to find out if you can get some help there. Dr. Schneider, what's coming up on Saturday? Tell people one more time.
On Saturday, we have the National Parkinson's Foundation of Greater Rochester Annual Parkinson's Symposium. The theme this year is Living Your Best Life. Yvonne will be the MC, and we have a number of speakers who will be coming to talk on a range of topics from quality of life to technology. And the importance of nutrition in Parkinson's disease.
It starts at 9 a.m. at the Hyatt Regency Rochester on Saturday. Registration opens at 8:15. Have a great event. Yvonne, have fun with that. And thank you one more time for sharing your story with our listeners. It's great to talk to you, and I really admire you. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Doctors, thank you. Pat, thank you. Good luck to you and your family, and thanks for sharing your story as well. A really remarkable hour here. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we will talk to you Wednesday on Member Supported Public Radio.